Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Inasmuch as this is a pioneer program, we find it only fitting tonight to pay tribute to a church in Fairbanks that today marked a half a century of history in this city. This morning, the Immaculate Conception Church marked its 50th anniversary, and we have with us today a man who was in Fairbanks when the church was first built. There's a rather odd story. He was not a member of the church at that time, but he is a very active member at this time. That man is Mr. George Preston. Mr. Preston, I'd like to ask you something about when the church first started. You were here and watched the activity. What effect did it have on this community? What was the first effect of the Catholic Church in this community?
Well, at that time, of course, I was not a Catholic, and I was new to the camp myself. I arrived on January 4th, 1904, and at that time I just got a job. My first job was the Northern Commercial Company, and I'm afraid I was too much taken up with my own affairs to recall what was the effect of the church when it was first built here. As a matter of fact, I didn't know Father Monroe until some years later than that.
Well, what was your first contact with Father Monroe? Was that after you had joined the church? What was it? How many years later?
My first contact with Father Monroe was after I got married, because my wife was a Catholic, and got acquainted with him in that way. And the first thing I remember about that was the trouble that arose over the moving of the church from first in Dunkel to its present location. There was considerable opposition on the part of many of the parishioners who were living in that neighborhood and didn't want to see it moved. Mm-hmm. But Father Monroe was a very determined sort of man when he had his mind made up on anything, and it was hard to turn him aside. And he finally got his own way. And we all acknowledge now that it was the right way.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was the idea? So
and,
that it would be...
Among other things, there was a petition sent around among his parishioners to try and prevent Father Monroe from making this move. And my wife, among others, signed that petition. Years afterwards, when I got acquainted with Father Monroe, he used to rub it in gently when he came to call on us, and I got quite a lot of fun out of it.
Well, what was the idea of moving the church? So it would be closer to the hospital?
Well, it was to have it close to the hospital, of course, mm-hmm. and it was in every way the proper thing to do.
Well, it's such an odd thing, though, to try to move a church across the river. One would think they would have just abandoned the building and built a new one. It must have taken...
Well, it would have been much more costly, the way Father Monroe figured it out. And as it turned out, they made a very good job of moving it across. I remember it being moved, but I was not a member of the church at that time, and consequently it was just one of the events in town that I noticed going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, you first came up here to work for the Northern Commercial Company,
is that right? No, I didn't.
Right?
I came in on my own just to take my chance in this new camp. I came over from Valdez.
Well, what were some of the activities that you underwent on the way up here? Was it just a long, hard trip?
Well, it was certainly a long, hard trip, because we left Valdez the day after Thanksgiving in 1903.
Mm-hmm.
And we pulled into Fairbanks on the evening of January 4th, 1904. And it was 50 below when we got here.
Were there any buildings where you could go in and get shelter?
We got a place to stop for the first few days over in Grail, from Mr. Harry Grail, after whom the Grail was named.
Mm-hmm.
And we stayed there for several days until we finally got another place in town. I think that cabin is still standing where we stayed until we left for the creeks, about 10 days or so after that.
Well, do you remember the construction of the hospital when it went up?
Yes, I remember that.
Well, they say that at the time that it went up, it was the most modern building in Alaska.
Well, there was a hospital here. It was a small hospital at St. Matthew's Church, but it was too small to accommodate the people that were needing hospital care here. As a matter of fact, they could only take care of, oh, not more than a dozen patients, I imagine. Mm-hmm. And Father Monroe was prevailed on to by some of the businessmen in town to undertake building a hospital. And there was some opposition to his going ahead with that because it was felt that it would hurt the St. Matthew's Hospital. But it all worked out right in the end because St. Matthew's Hospital would never have been able to take care of the... It was just a log hospital and very small. And eventually it was closed up because it was really too small to be any... not to be profitable operation. And St. Joseph's Hospital has been the...
Well, now, when you came to Fairbanks, was the Chena Bridge up at that time? The bridge across the Chena, this old Chena Bridge?
Oh, there was a wooden bridge at...
It wasn't this same bridge.
Oh, no, and the wooden bridge went out every year, you know, and went out every year at the breakup.
Oh, it did.
As a matter of fact, they made preparations for it going out, knowing that it would be carried out anyhow, and they used to take off the top piling and save that, and all that did go out when the ice finally broke loose was the piers. And immediately they started building another bridge, driving new piles and using the old decking.
Well, then there was a period every spring that you had to, you couldn't get across the river
with
a bridge.
Well, there was a ferry then, small ferry, just a boat ferry that took people from town across to the other side, and particularly to the railroad where they could get the train.
Oh, was that the situation at the time that the church was first moved? Did you have to take a ferry across, or was there a permanent bridge then?
Oh, there was a bridge. It was a good enough bridge at the time. It served all the year until just a week or two during the breakup.
Except for breakup. Mm-hmm. Well, I'll be darned.
It was always an exciting experience to see the ice... come down at that time. A far more exciting breakups than we have these days, for some reason or other. There's more water, for one thing, in the slough, and the pressure would build up against these pilings until finally they would break through, and then there was a big shout went up with people gathered alongside the bank.
Well, had the Northern Commercial Company been built when you got to Fairbanks?
Oh, yes. The Northern Commercial Company came here in 1903 and took over the Barnett Trading Post.
Was it the same building?
Which was established by Captain Barnett in 1902, I believe. Mm-hmm. Well, in the same location, yes. We had it was called the trading site, the Barnett Trading Site. It ran from First Avenue to Third Avenue.
How did you happen to go to work for a department store? Had you had that kind of experience before?
Well, I'd had that kind of experience as an office man in my native country of Scotland, and also in the Klondike, where I was working for a mining company. And while I had tried mining for something over a year and tried to rough it in the in the mines, it was not my life, and I knew that, and so I took the first opportunity of getting a job with another commercial company. And in order to get that job and make sure of it, I interviewed Judge Wickersham, whom I had become acquainted with in Valdez, and told the judge what my situation was, and I'd like to get a job with the Northern Commercial Company. So he took me down and introduced me to the then manager, Mr. Howard Turner. And I was given the job as sort of roustabout, because the rest of the crew were the office man, Dick Wood, and the store man, Jack Healy. And I was the rest of the crew.
You mean that's all that worked there?
That was all, yeah. I was... delivery man and general roustabout. and then, of course, there was the agent. That was early in 1904, in May 1904, that I went to work for the Northern Commercial Company.
You were with them a number of years, weren't you? You're with them a great number of years.
Oh, yes, and there's something that may not be known to many people, and that is that the manager who was here at that time, the first manager of the Northern Commerce Company, Mr. Howard Turner, is still alive at the age of 93.
Oh?
I saw him only 3 or 4 months ago. He's living in South San Francisco at the California Golf Club.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, what major differences do you see in the store now than you did then? Were there...
Oh, there's a revolution in the matter of storekeeping these days.
Did it have departments then, like it does now?
Well, there were no departments like that. We had a general assortment of stocks that would be used in a mining camp. But we had no goods for ladies that I remember at that time, unless they were content to use Levi Strauss, with plenty of them, and gum boots and rubber boots, but nothing else.
Well, did you service a fairly large area around the town? Did people have to come in here to shop, say, when they were out?
Oh, they had to come from the creeks, of course. But when I came here first, there were just a very limited number of people on the creeks. It was just after the cleanup that spring that the news got around the country that Fairbanks was really a gold camp. And then people began to make preparations to come in from all the surrounding gold camps and from the outside, particularly from Dawson, which was then beginning to decline as a gold mining camp. And the boats from all that summer and fall were crowded with people, all that could get down here.
You met your wife here in Fairbanks, is that right?
Yes, she was living with her aunt and uncle over at Bettles on the Koyvuk.
Oh.
Her uncle and aunt were Mr. and Mrs. Charles Grimm. And she had come in to visit them after she got through high school. She was just a young woman, 20 or 21. And she stayed with them for about a year and then came over here on her way back to the States with them and visited with her sister, Mrs. Richmond, who then had her first son, Wally Richmond Jr., now head of the company. And I met her at that time, and it was a little time after that, about a year after that, that we were married.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, you came first from Scotland to the United States and then up to Canada, is that right?
I came first from Scotland to the Klondike.
To the Klondike.
Yeah. And was there from 1900, the spring of 1900 to 1902, the fall. Went outside and was in Vancouver for a little while, a few months, the winter, and in the spring of 1903, came up to Valdez and went into the Copper River country to a new gold strike there in the Nazina country.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we stayed there until all that summer, and with not too much luck in the matter of gold mining. I wasn't engaged in mining myself. I was working as cook for the crew that was mining there in this small outfit. And in the fall, when we got back to Valdez, there was news of the strike in the Tanana. There was also news of the strike in the Susitna. And as it happened, the Susitna could show some gold, because in Al White's saloon in Valdez there was a great big glass vase that was filled with gold, newly mined gold from the Susitna, but there was not as much as a small nugget from Tanana. But in inquiring around, my friends, who were more experienced than I was in the matter of mining, decided that this the reports from Tanana were much more favorable as indicating a real gold camp. And so we decided to come here. My partner at that time was Mr. Jim Stewart, who was still living. and is in this district. We got a little outfit together, and we joined in with seven other men. I think there were five dog teams and nine men altogether who came over from Valdez to Tanana, into Fairbanks. And I've been here ever since.
Well, we're certainly happy that you got here, Mr. Preston, and that you could be with us today. We have enjoyed talking to you. And again, we want to salute not only our pioneer guest, but the Pioneer Church. The 50-year birthday today of the Catholic Church in Fairbanks.
Yeah. Too many this and that for a traitor to do any mass cheating. He may be individual cheating, but not mass cheating.
Well, there's no question about it, George Goshaw. There's certainly been progress in Alaska.
You mean to tell me you've had me on this year?
We just cut you on right at the end there. I didn't want to stop it. It was a good story.
Yes.
But you know, George Goshaw is a fairly familiar figure around Fairbanks. We get to see him when he comes down from Nome, several times every year you pass through Fairbanks, don't you, George?
Yes, several times a year in the past 3 or 4 years.
Yeah. I know ever since I've been up here, I can expect a visit every few months. I'll tell you, we were talking before we went on the air about some of the pioneers who, well, you think of them when you're in Fairbanks. You see their names on the corner street posts, and maybe you'd like to tell the audience a bit about that.
Well, of course, when I think of Fairbanks, my first pioneer of the early days, I think of Judge Wickersham. He is, as you know, one of our early day judges here in the Fairbanks District, which was at that time the third division of Alaska. That extended from the coast at Valdez in here to Fairbanks, up and down the river, and the Koyukuk District. Later, in 1908, of course, it became the fourth division. And the Valdez, as is today, was still the third division. Then I noticed that when I think about Wickersham, who was our pioneer district judge, he was a very handsome man, was known as Wick among his personal friends, and by others as Handsome Jim, because he was a colorful man. And he held court, too, in all of the four divisions of Alaska. Other judges have since held court in the four divisions, but he was one of the first men to do so.
Well, how did he get around to the different
those days
courts?
He went up and down the river by boat. Then in the wintertime, he traveled by horse stage or by dogs. And as you well know, too, Jim Wickersham, he led one of our early day parties into the Mount McKinley country and surmounted that mountain, one among the first to do so. And thinking of the mountain itself, then I can say that one Dickey was the man back in 1998 who named the mountain McKinley, and the smaller mountain, 18,000-foot mountain, he named Foraker after Senator Foraker of Ohio. Of course, McKinley came from Ohio, too.
Mm-hmm.
And
I imagine Dickey came from Ohio also.
Well, perhaps he did. But Dickey was one of our early day pioneers down in Prince William Sound. He developed copper properties, was never overly successful, but lived a very fine life. He had a wife and two children, a boy and a girl.
Not in relation to our chamber manager.
No, Don Dickey really has a heritage here because as a chamber manager, he has something to shoot at. Not necessarily in the naming of mountains or rivers or lakes, but in the developing of Mount McKinley. He has an object there which he could pioneer as a Dickey, and which should be done. That is much, one can say much about Mount McKinley, but it is the greatest attraction we have to offer in Alaska for tourists into Fairbanks and into Anchorage.
Well, I think they're certainly doing a fine job with it now down there. Who are some of the other pioneers you remember?
Well, I might speak about Barnett. Barnett, as you know, he came into the country in 1902. He came up the Chena Slough in the small-powered steamboat and started a trading post here in this vicinity. And later, after the camp opened up in 1903 and 4, he went into the banking business. And as you Fairbanks know, as you walk about your street, you find a street named Barnett. Then there was another street named of a man that I knew in the early days, and then later in the stampede in the Chisena country, he came in there in 1914, and that was one of the first commissioners you had here in Fairbank. His name was Kroll.
I was going to ask you what you were doing back in those days, George. Were you stampeding?
I landed in Alaska in 1902 at Skagway, and then winter of 1903 and 4, I mushed in here to Fairbanks and later went down the river to Nome in 1904. And I was just looking for that golden beach or that gold that was in the ground. I did some mining and generally mostly in the merchandising business.
Well, what was early day Fairbanks like then when you...
Fairbanks was a log cabin camp. It was all one small one-room cabin, some of the larger ones, and then the stores and saloons. They were two-story log cabins and large log cabins. There was no lumber brought into the country except that which was whipsawed right here, and it sold as high as $100 a thousand at that particular time. Now, of course, you have today's prices, which
prices
are much more.
Prices have gone down a little, maybe. Well, you went on up to Nome fairly early, didn't you? You've been up there a number of years.
Yes, I've been up in the Nome region with time out in the 3rd Division, and out in the States during the war. I've been in the country 50 years in the Nome district.
There's only, what, about four of you up there now, aren't there? Somebody was telling me the other day, I guess it was Joe Ulmer?
Joe Ulmer.
Was telling me that there was you and... Tony Paulette, I believe, and Mrs. Ford, and several that were in Nome way back in the early days.
No, I think that information is somewhat erroneous because there's quite a number of people that landed in Nome in 1909 and 1900. The early day pioneers of Nome right now, we had one who left Fairbanks today for Nome, who arrived in Nome in 1899. That is Mrs. Mike Walsh. She is the only woman that now lives in Nome who arrived there at that time. There's four or five men that also arrived in 99, and that is Peter X. Peterson and Mr. Swanberg.
Nell
Swanberg is 1900, and he raised his family there, and he was married, and he spent his 50-year anniversary, his golden wedding anniversary, he celebrated in Nome here 2 years ago.
See, a whole bunch of you got together the other day, didn't you, to send a letter down to Mr. Waskey?
Oh, Frank Waskey. Frank Waskey is our early day pioneer who was elected as the first delegate to Washington in 1906, and he arrived in Washington in 1907, and that one of his first legislation that he presented to Congress was for the putting in of a land office here in Fairbanks and at Nome. And much other early-day legislation was started by Waskey while a delegate in 1907. Frank Waskey was a Nomeite, a miner, and recently, for the past year, he has moved from Dillingham on Bristol Bay to Maryland, Orland, Maryland, there where he had a small shop displaying rocks and minerals for trade. Now he's returned to Alaska, going through Anchorage last week to Dillingham, where he will be for the summer. While he went through Seattle, he was entertained by the Nome Alaska Club, and entertained there at lunch at the Arctic Club, and many of the early day friends and others who knew him congregated there and in honor of his being there at the time. He is now, as I stated, back at Dillingham, and we expect him up in Nome for a visit this summer, and he plans to go as far north as Kotzebue and Point Hope.
You say he's back in Alaska now?
Yes, he is at Dillingham.
Well, tell us some more about Early Day Nome.
Well, Early Day Nome comes to us from 1898, when three white men, one named Brindiston, one named Lindeberg, and the third named Lindblom, they came up from Gulliver. A report came in to Gulliver at the missionary stating that the gold had been discovered by an Eskimo in 97. So they followed that trail and went to Anvil Creek, back of Nome, and there they discovered free gold on the creek, which they named Anvil Creek. The mountain was called Anvil Mountain because on its top was a huge rock that resembled a blacksmith anvil. And most of the creeks took off from Anvil Creek, and they found gold on all of them, which caused a stampede in 98, the first real big stampede we had here in Alaska. Upwards of some 20,000 people were there the first year. The camp was known, too, as Anvil City. Later in 1900, when they made application for an incorporation, the town or camp became Nome, as it is today.
Well, you know, I think it's only fair. I'm having difficulty getting George to talk about himself, but I'm going to put in a few little words now, because George Goshaw is one of the most progressive pioneers I've met since I've been in Alaska. His letterhead, which I'm looking at right now, the Northwest Alaska Chamber of Commerce. He's a member of that. He's a member of the American Legion. He's been boosting for a road to Nome for as long as I can remember, and I know he makes periodic visits back to Washington, D.C., just so they don't forget that the 2nd Division is up there. And he's a fabulous person in a number of ways. I would like to describe George a little bit. He has kind of a John L. Lewis look about him in a way. He has a very strong face, and when he looks at you, his eyes just go right through you, and they don't miss a thing, I'll tell you. But, George, you have an interesting theory about pioneers and the old times and the old stories that I haven't heard advanced before, sort of that you don't believe in living in the past.
To accomplish something for tomorrow, one cannot live in the past to tell about all those things that's happened by men now dead or living outside in the States. It's my personal belief that old pioneers like myself should look into the future for the young pioneers of today and so assist them in this and that and bring to their attention different developments which should be done here for the good of Alaska and for the future of our territory and the future of our country at large. And if we take time out to go into old matters, old developments of mines already mined out and roads that are no longer used or needed, then we use up that time and don't devote it for something which we should devote it to for future development. It's my belief that the greatest thing that we have here in Fairbanks today for promotions of the Fairbanks District is a road into Nome. It would, I believe, develop our tourist industry by the hundreds of thousands, not for the 100,000 which we expect here this year, but it would double and treble each year. And a great number of people would use Fairbanks here as a focal point and a point to go from here down to Anchorage and Valdez and into that area and again come back here and go into Nome and go up to Cape Prince of Wales, where from that vantage point they would look over across the Bering Straits into Siberia, see the Diomede Islands. From that point they could see two oceans and the Bering Straits, which divides two continents, the continent of Asia and our own North American continent. It has a great future, and the young men of today and the young women of today, if they devote their time and development, they would all pull for a highway into Nome and become pioneers. The pioneers are not devoted to the old-timers who opened up the country, who first blazed the trails here into Fairbanks or into Nome or into the Koyukuk or into the Iditarod, But they would now use the means of fast transportation, motor transportation, and get around the country. You're down to Nome in probably a day or a day and a half at its longest, whereas in the early days, by dog team, it would take me nearly a month to come from Nome here, generally under 20 days. But sometimes you're storm-bound throughout your course of travel, and, of course, it takes longer.
Well, thank you, George Goshaw. I think you have a fine idea there, and I'm hoping that you push it through to completion. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We have a fine guest for you this evening, a fellow that's been a friend of ours up at KFAR for a number of years, and a man who is an expert on a community that's a neighbor of ours down the railroad, and that community is Nenana. Our guest is Charlie Wilson, who's been in Nenana how many years now, Charlie?
32.
32 years.
Came up there in 22.
Well, I thought it'd be kind of interesting maybe if we could talk to Charlie Wilson about some of the history of the Nenana Ice Classic. That's a big subject, and although it's over and done with for the year, there are probably many people who don't know how it started and how it's developed. Would you like to tell us a little about that?
Well, how it started in the first place, the chief engineer of the Alaska Railroad on this end, that's when they started to build the road first in 1916 and 17. Started in 1917 with just about 100 tickets, I believe. But the tickets today are a duplicate of the original tickets that this engineer drew out.
Never been changed.
Just exactly the same thing. Only the date has changed. That's the only thing on there.
Huh. Well, what were they, just bored or something, trying to think of something to do?
No, it was just something to do in the spring.
Yeah?
And I think the first pool was only about $100.
Well, for heaven's sake. Well, you said before we went on the air that you helped build the first waterways in Nenana, isn't that
right? No, marine ways.
Marine ways. What's that?
And that's
now?
Where they pull the boats out, for the winter. They're skids. There's permanent skids that's built on the ground on a slope that runs down to the riverbank. And about 1,500 feet long. And then the full length of all the boats that were in the river at the time were all pulled out on them. And when in the fall, there's an extra skid put out, 60-foot skids. They use that, and they push them under the boats. Then they put the cables around the boats and pull the boats right up on these skids.
Is that right? So dry dock them for the
winter.
That's
what it is, yes. But the correct name is a marine ways.
Oh, I've never heard of that.
A dry dock is a dock that you float the boat into.
Oh, I see.
And then pump the water out or raise the dock. But this way here, everything had just got to be pulled out sideways.
That must be quite a job.
It is quite a job there. Now they have a lot of steam capstans along there, and everything was run by steam at the time.
Yeah.
And they had their own boiler house and power plant. Got every carpenter shop, paint lockers, got everything right there.
Well, say, tell me, what happened how many years ago, or were you around when the boating center used to be here at Fairbanks, didn't it?
Oh, that's many years ago. That's before I came up to Nenana.
When did Nenana start being the shipping headquarters there?
In 1922 and 23.
Mm-hmm.
That was the head of navigation then. Well, there were only four boats on the run at the time. There was two from the White Pass. That's the Yukon and the Alaska. They used to run up to Dawson and bring the tourists down.
Mm-hmm.
And there's two belong to the Army. That was turned over to the Alaska Railroad. That was the General Jacobs and the General Davis. They belonged to the Signal Corps originally. They used to run up and down the river and keep all the lines of communication open and bring up supplies for all the Signal Corps stations all the way along the line.
Oh, I see. Well, what about the boats that are in the running now? They're still the railroad boats, and
they're railroad boats.
They're
new.
Well,
Don Peterson has one boat in the river this year. I don't think he's made a trip yet. But the Black Navigation, they've got three boats on the run, the barges. And the CAA got about 5 boats out already in their loads. They're all out of town now. And the railroad, the steamer Nenana, went up to Whitehorse. Let me see what day it is. Last Monday, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And she had about 500 tons of freight. And the steamer Terranor is on the way, left the day before that for Marshall. Two boys ordered about 600 or 700 tons. And the Yukon made a trip to Terranor and then came back again. And she was loaded up and left the day that I came up on Wednesday morning.
Well, has Nenana changed appreciably since you first got there in 22?
Oh, yes, it's quite a town then. When I came there first, there were about 1,800 people there.
Is that right? Well, where'd they all move out to?
All scattered all over as the work finished up, all the construction work finished around there. And then the railroad took all, they had the machine shops, the roundhouse. That was the head of the railroad for years, you know, until 23, until they finished the bridge.
Oh.
Then right after, in 23, they took everything on there. Fairbanks got part of the roundhouse and machine shop and that stuff, and Healy got the other. That split up they made two divisions out of it now.
Yeah.
Oh, everything moved down there.
Well, what'd you do before you went to Nenana? How'd you happen to come up to Alaska?
Oh, I just had some friends up here in the Circle Country, came up here and do a little prospecting.
When was that?
In 1913, April 1913.
How did you come up?
I came over from Valdez, walked over.
You did?
To Fairbanks.
Hmm. What part of the year did you walk?
In April, early in April, just before the breakup.
Was there a big bunch of people with you, or did you?
No, it was just for three of us started out. Two of them went back.
Is that right? Were you the only one to come clear through?
That bunch, yeah.
Well, how did you get along out on the trail like that? How did you live? Did you have to carry a lot of things with you?
No. The NC Company, they had horses and wagons on the run there, too. They packed the mail and the baggage and all that stuff. All you had to do was travel light, and you could beat the wagon, too. You could beat them.
Is that right?
They stop about every 20 miles. They'd stop for changes, horses, and we'd walk right through past them.
Well, you knew if you ever got stuck, you'd still have somebody there.
Oh, there's always somebody coming behind.
Mm-hmm. Well, we talked, I think when we were talking to Ed Farrell about the trail, he mentioned that the prices were pretty high along the road for various things.
Yeah, it all depends on where you stopped. Some of the prices were way high.
Uh-huh.
If they thought you had the money, they'd... How you looked. If you had good clothes and you looked like you had money, it cost you that much.
Yeah, how'd you look, Charlie?
Huh? I didn't have very much. I learned about that before I came up.
You looked as bad as you could, huh? Well, you went on up then, you say, to the central...
The circle.
Circle area.
Uh-huh. Up around Birch Creek.
And how long were you up there?
Up there for over a year. Then I went out. Took a trip out again, then came back in 16. I went out in the fall of 16 again. I didn't come back again. Then I went out and got a little patriotic whiskey and got in the Army spring of 17. I didn't get back till April of 19 when I came back from France. 3 days after I was paid off, I was on the trail.
Is that... Well, sounds to me like you sort of tried to leave Alaska a few times and always...
No, I just went for a trip.
Call you back. Well, now, down in Nenana, what do you do now? I know you're still real active with the VFW.
No, I haven't done anything since 1946. I retired from the railroad.
Mm-hmm.
Retired engineer. Take it nice and easy. Go when I feel like it. Come back when I feel like it.
Yeah.
Maintain a home there all the time.
Well, now, as working for the railroad, they say that you just haven't lived till you've taken that Alaska Railroad run, that it's one of the most beautiful runs there is.
It is a nice trip, especially now with these streamliners.
How many years were you on the
26.
Railroad? Is that right? I never realized that.
Yeah, 26 years with them.
Well, were there, I guess you've seen a lot of changes in it since the beginning, haven't you?
Oh, yes. See, when this railroad, when I made the first trip to Fairbanks, there's a narrow gauge then.
Huh.
We had the old one spot and the five spot on the run here then.
Now, what's the one spot and the five spot?
The one spot is this old dinky in front of the depot here now.
Well, now, how many cars could that thing pull? I've looked at it so many times.
Oh, full of quite a little gauge. When we fill it, I run most of the time when we're done on the fill. We're filling in all those holes between North Nenana and the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And usually they were out with six good-sized carloads of rock and dump that, fill them in.
Well, for Pete's sake, you wouldn't think that little thing could pull a man.
They walk right along.
What did they use for fuel in those little train engines?
Oh, Healy coal.
They used the coal, huh?
And originally, in the early days, before they got the coal in there, they burned wood on this side.
Well, now...
When the Tenor Valley had the... it was the Tenor Valley Railroad before. Alaska Railroad took it over.
Is that right? Well, you worked for it back in the years.
I didn't work for the Tenor Valley. As soon as Alaska Railroad took it over, I worked for it.
Well, was it the Alaska Railroad that made it into a standard gauge?
Yes, the standard gauge was running there until the bridge was finished.
Mm-hmm.
The narrow gauge run right along there. At North Nenana, all the docks were at North Nenana then. And everything from Fairbanks County was landed by the White Pass boats over at North Nenana and shipped narrow gauge right up here to Chena and Fairbanks.
Oh, mm-hmm.
In the wintertime, they laid the track on top of the ice. And they go over there and they land right out, they unload out of the standard gauge into the narrow gauge cars over there all through the winter. And just before the break up in the spring, they take up all the track and ties.
For heaven's sake.
In the summertime, they had a small boat, the old Sunbeam, used to tow a barge across there.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only way mode of travel at the time.
Well, there was some controversy here recently, as I remember, about which of these little narrow gauge engines was the first one. Do you know anything about that?
I believe this one was the first.
This one that's here at Fairbanks.
But the Alaska Railroad had a one spot of their own on the other end, over on the Seward end in the early days, too.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe this one is the original. But that didn't belong to the Alaska Railroad at the time. It belonged to the Tanana Valley Railroad.
Well, who owned this Tanana Valley Railroad?
That's the syndicate right here in town.
It was put up just by local people up here? Well, now, isn't that strange? I'd never heard of it.
They run to Chattanooga. All the way out to the creeks out there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, most of that FE stuff was towed out by narrow gauge.
Yeah. Well, now, does the FE use anything like that anymore,
no,
or is it all gone?
All gone now. They have standard gauge. Everything is hauled out on the road from now on out that way.
Mm-hmm.
The only standard gauge there is now and out to Ladfield and Ileson and Big D out that way.
Mm-hmm.
That's all there is now, the railroad.
And there's still a little bit of remaining narrow gauge up at Nome, isn't there? You hear about that once
in a while. Oh, yes, yeah. That's the dogmobile.
Yeah.
And I believe that's still open, too. The local miners, they're the only ones that operate that.
Uh-huh.
But I don't believe anybody owns it.
Well, you know, Charlie, we always get such a kick out of you down during breakup time. Charlie reads so extensively. What were some of those books you had the year that Dick was down there covering the ice breakup? You had a whole bunch of material on all kinds of Alaska items.
I remember now.
Don't you remember? I think you'd gotten them from the governor or some such thing.
Now I got quite a lot of stuff on in the country.
Yeah, well, have you ever thought yourself about compiling them and making up some kind of a book?
No time. I've been asked that 100 times again.
Is that right? Well, tell us a good northern yarn now. Here we got you on the radio and everything.
Well, I really don't know any good one unless not tell the truth. Most of them. Have you read a lot of these Alaska books that's written in New York City?
Yes, indeed.
I have, too. I've thrown them against the wall lots of times, and then pick it up again to see if it's any it gets any worse.
That's one of my big pet peeves, are the people that come up here for 2 days and write a book. That's why I wondered why some of you old-timers don't do it.
Well, we have lots of old-timers here that are writers. Why don't they?
Well, that's a good thought, too.
Uh-huh. We have some very good writers in this country here with it.
Down around Nenana, who are some of your more famous old-timers, Charlie?
Oh, old Slim Avery. And Sure Shot Kennedy. I guess everybody in Alaska knows him.
Yeah.
He's one of the
old sports. Do you know how he got his nickname?
Yeah, hockey. Sure Shot, when he was shooting for the goals. He was a professional hockey player when he came in. That's the way he came into the country. Into the Dawson country.
Is that right?
And he was a baseball player, a very, very good ball player, one of the best that ever hit the country.
Hmm.
Well, old George got pretty well shot now.
Well, you know, the thing that amazed me about Nenana is that just about everybody down there has a nickname.
I get old Piccolo Pete.
Yeah, I remember him from down around the river. What does he walk along swinging a stick?
Yeah. Then we had another one down there, old Whistling Rufus. He couldn't speak to you without stopping to whistle a little and then talk some more.
Oh, which was the one, the two, you told me this story a couple years ago, the two school teachers that came to visit their brother? Do you remember that story? He had a nickname. And he'd moved out in the bush someplace and was living.
Oh, that was Whiskey Jack.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. His name was Burchard, Jack Burchard. His two sisters came in to see him. And he told them that he couldn't land down there where he was at. And sent word to them that he lived down out of Tanano at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Down there, down close to the Butchers. And he told them there was no place for them to live down there. They're all natives around there. And there was no tent, no place, no, not a cabin available in the country. So the sisters, they bought a tent and all the equipment to go with it, moved on down, and they got down there and stayed with Jack for a while. I just fooled him and beat the band.
Oh, in the meantime, he'd acquired his nickname, huh?
Well, he manufactured thousands and thousands of gallons. That's where he got the name.
Oh. Well, Charlie, I don't think you've ever been given a nickname, but... I don't know, you've certainly been a fine friend to us up here, and we're glad that you could have been with us today. Were you ever given a nickname?
No. Uh-huh.
No? Just plain Charlie Wilson.
I've always kept away from nicknames if I could.
Well, we certainly want to thank you for being our guest today. Charlie Wilson from Nenana.
Well, it's been a pleasure to be with you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You know, one thing when you're interviewing pioneers, you have to be a little bit careful because you always figure that there are a few pioneers in the audience listening with pretty critical ear because they have been through most of these experiences, know the straight story. Our guest this evening has sort of good-naturedly ribbed a number of our other guests by calling them chechacos. Not because they've just been here a few years, but because they haven't been here over 54 years, which was the turn of the century. Our guest this evening came into Alaska 3 years before the turn of the century, in 1897. I'd like to introduce him to you now. Many of you probably know him already. Alfred, or Al McLeod. Mr. McLeod, how did you happen to head up to Alaska so early?
Well, of course, the main problem was to get into this gold rush to make money, of course. And that way I started from the States and come out to the coast, that is, Pacific coast. I left Milwaukee first. That's where I was located at the time. Come to Vancouver, Washington. And from there, on the steamship Centennial to Vancouver, British Columbia. That's where I outfitted to come to the Yukon Territory. That was in the fall of 97. And that boat fetched us to Skagway. We arrived at Skagway on the 19th day of October, 97. That is one day after Alaska Day. But, of course, I didn't know it at the time.
Your birthday's on Alaska Day, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
How old will you be next Alaska Day?
I'll be 79. 79. And, of course, you land on Skagway, as I said, on the 19th day of October. And I put in all that winter between Skagway and Dyea, backwards and forwards, and carrying this little bit of grub that I had piled up in different places at different times. You know, you have to keep moving it with you when you go anywhere. But I put most of the winter in Dyea that winter.
Well, you know, I about halfway insulted Mr. McLeod yesterday. I knew that he was pretty close to 80, and I figured, well, four flights of steps up to KFAR were just too many stairs for a gentleman of that age to master. And so we took some portable recording equipment up to his home, and he was insulted. He said, I have been over that path 75 times, and if there's four flights of steps that's going to hold me back, I don't know where they'd be.
Well, of course, when you land at Dyea, it's quite a long ways up to the foot of the Dyea Pass, and it's pretty steep, even till you get to the Dyea Pass. You can be walking up that that ravine there, and a man could be coming towards you, and if he's probably 200 or 300 feet ahead of you, you can't only see his feet. It's that much grade going up. So there's quite a grade where they're going to build that tin, or not that tin, but that aluminum plant. There's a big grade from there up to the foot of the Chilicoot Pass.
Well, you told me something yesterday about an epidemic of spinal meningitis that broke out in the pass, and that's a story I hadn't heard before.
Well, that was down that was on the way down after I went over the pass. I don't know. I never did hear whether there was any on the other side or not. It seemed to be on the Yukon side of the pass, where that's where I was stricken with the spinal meningitis.
Well, what a terrible thing. Did you have any doctor's care?
Yeah, there was a doctor there, Dr. Frizzell from Los Angeles. He was traveling through there, but he had absolutely nothing in the way of medicine or anything. All he had was his knowledge of diseases of any kind. And I can't recall that he gave me any medicine.
You got a case of meningitis yourself?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah, I was laid up, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 weeks. And in a tent, and I had to keep the fire going myself, too, when there was a fire, you know. That is, sometimes I'd let it go out. Of course, I was probably in bed, but I didn't have too many clothes either to keep warm, you know. I'd have to have a fire. But I managed to get around somehow. I don't know. I could reach out of the bed lots of times and put a stick in the stove without getting out of bed, too. See? But anyway, this doctor, he recommended the only medicine we could get was whiskey. That was that contraband whiskey I was telling you about that this Jack Conway was shipping into, or fetching into Dawson. He wasn't shipping it because it was not allowed to be shipped. It was contraband. Or what do you mean, that other word for that?
Bootleg?
Yeah. So anyway, we got, I don't know how many bottles, but I could take that whiskey and drink it and eat it with sugar and keep on all day for 24 hours. Never had no effect on me, not whatsoever.
You know, I'm kind of surprised they brought any whiskey up into Alaska. You know, we don't have any snakes up here. They don't need that snake bite.
No, they don't need... No, there's no snakes. But I guess it's a cure. They used to claim it was quite a cure for colds and stuff, this Hudson Bay rum, you know. Was quite a cure for colds, but you had to have it hot, of course. Take it hot. Then after a while, you get so many, you don't care whether you got a cold or not. There's the idea.
What'd you do? Heat it up on a little campfire out on the trail and...
What do you mean,
when
the whiskey?
When you were treating yourself, yeah.
No, I just take it cold, right out of the bottle. The colder it was, the better, seemed like to me. Yeah. But I was at the tent all the time when I had this spinal meningitis, you know. I had it living in the tent. But, of course, I got over this spinal meningitis, at least I thought I was over it. And I took my little sleigh and going up on top of the Chilicoot Pass to get another load of grub, but I couldn't make it. I had to stand the sleigh up in the snow and go back to the tent. I went about probably a mile. So I went back and stayed in the tent until I got well enough so I could go.
Well, you know, there's one thing about Alaska that has impressed me, and particularly impressed me with the old-timers in Alaska, is their complete and utter generosity and their interest in their fellow man. You told me a story yesterday that sort of followed along with the theme of the complete, lack of selfishness among the old-time Alaskans.
Yeah, that does apply here, all right. There's no question about that. But I think we're probably getting away. We haven't got down as far as Lake Bennett yet, where that doctor got drowned.
That's right. I forgot about that. That's where the ice was.
This Dr. Frizzell that kind of looked after me, he, in the meantime, had went down Lake Bennett to nearly the bottom, or foot of Lake Bennett, as I understood. And I didn't know he was down there. So, along in the spring of the year, when the ice is melting, as I described to you last night, Lake Bennett, like today, had ice all over it. That was on June the 1st, 98.
Is that right?
And June the 2nd of the morning, there wasn't a speck of ice nowhere to be seen. The wind came up and just mixed all that ice and water up, and it all disappeared overnight, see? So this Dr. Frizzell, as I was telling you last night, he was out on this ice. He was out on this ice with a sleigh. And the dogs had broke through, and the sleigh had broke through, and they was laying flat on this ice. Well, we tried to get out to them with boats and boards laying on this ice, but we never could make it. We'd go through even with the boards and the boat. And, of course, they all drowned right there. Now, as I understood it, Dr. Frizzell was among them.
They never recovered the body?
No, I don't think so. Not that I ever knew of. Of course, we went down the river, and, of course, you never had no way of communicating with anybody from that time on. So yeah. I never did know. But I presume that they never did find him. I don't believe so.
Hmm. No.
So I think that about winds that up as far as that goes. Of course, there's a long trip down the Yukon yet, but...
There was one thing you told me about, Mr. McLeod, and that was the special seats that were built for the miners with the packs on their back. I had never heard about those before.
Yeah, that's just a kind of a rest, so you wouldn't have to take this pack on off you. No, it's quite a little job, but you take a pack off of you. You've got to unloose the straps here, and you're only going to sit down for a few minutes. Why?
Uh-huh.
You just sit down in this chair, and there's a little rest behind you. That's all. There's all the difference. There's a little rest behind you. You sit that pack on, you can relax.
Well, like yourself, how many pounds of supplies you figure you were carrying?
Well, I tell you, of course, I've seen lots of them as a carrier. They say they can carry 200 pounds, but 50 pounds and 55 pounds is plenty for me if you want to keep it up. I don't believe in carrying too much. I don't believe in carrying too much like that at one time.
Well, now,
50, 60 pounds or so like that. But
in riding the G-poles, is that the word they
Well,
use?
Yeah, that's the G-pole.
Could you manage a pack with a
Well, you don't have no pack when you got the G-pole. You've got everything on the sleigh.
Mm-hmm.
When you got a G-pole, why, you've got everything back on your sleigh. And you're riding the G-pole. You're just hanging on to it. You're not riding it in a sense of the word. You just got your both hands on it and hanging on. You're sliding with the sleigh, like going down on the side of the Chilicoot Pass, going down towards Lake Linderman.
Mm-hmm.
You're just riding the G-pole so you don't get under the sleigh, that's all. And you're going down, you can't stop either. You just got to keep going till you get to the bottom. That's all there's about it.
Yeah.
No matter whether you're under the sleigh or over the sleigh, if you get under it and the sleigh goes over it, you keep on going anyway, right behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there you are.
Well, with all due credit to pioneer businesses, and our emphasis is on the pioneers this week because, of course, the 52nd anniversary of the gold strike is coming up next week, as you all know, and our Golden Days celebration will begin tomorrow. I still would like you to tell that story, Mr. McLeod, about the stocking, the baby stocking fund.
The baby stocking fund? Well, back here in Fairbanks, the year 1908, of course, all the mining at that time was what we'd call drift mining, or most of it was all drift mining at that time.
Is that where they pan?
Well, yeah, they pan to find out the valuation of the ground, mostly.
Mm-hmm.
But the ground was all hoisted on top and run through the sluice boxes by buckets, see? Run by a cable and had power on top, dig a hole right straight down the ground, maybe 150 feet or whatever depth that you might have to go. And that way, that's what they call drift mining. mostly. It was mostly all drift mining at that time. There was a few they called open cut, too. But leading to this particular thing we're going to talk about, this man come from the outside.
You don't remember his name?
No, I don't. I believe the news miner should have that, because they was the chief depot for collecting this money.
Just as they do now.
Yes, they do. They was at that time. The news miner was the chief place. As I was telling you last night about this fellow was trying to bunt the goat, and he had the $50 in his hand. He wanted to know where the news miner was so he could deposit this money. Well, anyway, getting back to the instance where this fellow come from the outside, I believe it was from Washington State, and nobody knew him here. He was an absolute stranger. Only here 30 days when he went to work down there. Or 30 days when he got killed, at least. He got killed in this mine. He was working for the Berry Brothers on Esther Creek, which is not very far from here. And in going through his effects, his grips or whatever it may be, or a bag or whatever it was, among his effects was a little baby stocking. One that'd be crawling around the floor with maybe 3 or 4 or 5 inches long, I suppose, something like that. Baby stocking, anyway. Well, that was in his effect. So when they wrote out to his wife, when they found out he did have a wife, nobody knew at the time, but they did find out he had a wife, and they wrote to her and told her what they had found in his belongings, you see. And she wrote back and said she had missed that little stocking, that little baby stocking, but she never knew where it went to. But the mystery was cleaned up when they went through and found it there. So immediately they got word back from her that she was the wife of this particular man that got killed here, and they had a little daughter. Why, just like a wildfire, if you may term it that way, everybody started in, and they raised $7,500 for her here, her and that child, in 3 weeks. Just took that long for her to raise that money. And that was stipulated that $5,000, I believe, would go for the maintenance of that child until she was 18 or 21 or whatever it was, and the $2,500 then to put her through college if there was any money left after that. Now, if that covers it all, this quits quite a story, but I guess that's probably the gist of the whole thing.
Well, Mr. McLeod, it's just one of the many, many stories of the Northland, and each week I feel the same way, that it's so difficult to compass a man's life in 15 minutes. I hope we've hit some of the highlights of yours, and I hope that our audience has enjoyed our program this evening. And I especially want to...